Good afternoon. This is Bob Krueger with Thought for Food column for August 2020. This program is heard on the third Wednesday of the month at 4 p.m. and repeated on the third Saturday of the month at 3 p.m. It's intended for a blind and print-impaired audience, but hopefully it'll be interest to everyone. August is the only month without a national holiday, but it has some significant days. August 1st is Air Force Day. The 2nd is the 141st anniversary of the Washington Monument. The United States Coast Guard was established on the 4th in 1790. The Purple Heart Medal was established on the 7th in 1782. World War II ended on August 14th, 1945. National Aviation Day is the 19th, and Women's Equality Day is observed on the 26th. This is another time to ask the question, are you aware of this? 600 miles from the North Pole, on an island the size of West Virginia, at the end of a tunnel bored into a mountain, lies a vault filled with more than a million samples of seeds harvested from 6,374 species of plants grown in 249 locations around the globe. The collection, the largest of its kind, is intended to safeguard the diversity of crops that feed the world. If disaster wipes out a plant, seeds from the vault could be used to restore the species. If pests, disease, or climate change imperil a food source, a resistant trait found among the collection could thwart that threat. While most countries have their own seed banks, Colorado State University has one for the United States. The Svalbard Global Seed Bank serves as a backup. The vault, built in 2008 for about $9 million, is owned and managed by Norway, but its contents are... The contents belong to countries and places that provide the samples. It works like a safety deposit box at the bank, said Kerry Fowler, an American agriculturist who helped found the vault. Norway owns the facility, but not the boxes of seeds. So far, only one depositor has needed to withdraw its samples from the vault. In 2015, after the International Center for Agricultural Research in the dry areas was destroyed in the Syrian Civil War, scientists who had fled the country withdrew seeds to regenerate the plants in Lebanon and Morocco. It had one of the world's biggest and best collections of wheat, barley, lentils, chickpeas, faba beans, and grass peas, Dr. Fowler said. It was the chief supplier of a disease-resistant wheat variety for the Middle East. In 2017, a group returned copies of its seeds to the vault. The 18,540 square foot seed vault includes three rooms with the capacity to house 4.5 million samples of 500 seeds each, a maximum of 2.25 billion seeds. The environment's natural temperature remains below freezing year round, but seeds are stored in a chillier minus 18 degrees Celsius or around 0.4 degrees Fahrenheit. Expected to last for decades, centuries, or perhaps even millennia. Lettuce is on the short end, Dr. Fowler said. It only lasts 50 to 75 years. On the top end, if we can rely on experimental results, sorghum will last more than 19,000 years. If you look at rice, wheat, or peas, we're talking a couple of thousand years. In reality, it's expected that as depositors renew their own seed stocks, they will also send fresh samples to the vault. While dwindling diversity might not seem like an imminent threat, four chemical companies now control more than 60% of the global proprietary seed sales, including cotton, corn, soybeans, and canola, according to Philip H. Howard, an associate professor at Michigan State University who tracks changes in seed industry structure. That concentration of power, some worry, could lead to less agricultural variety and more genetic uniformity. The longer-term question is, with very small numbers of competitors, are firms going to reduce research efforts? Asked James McDonald, a research professor at the University of Maryland and formerly an economist at the USDA. The concern is with cannibalization. if I have 50% of the market and a rival has 50%, and I develop a new seed variety, it will steal sales from my rivals, but it'll also steal sales from me. There's less incentive to invest. The seed industry doesn't share that concern. We see new varieties coming into the market every single year with just about every crop you can name, said Andy Levine, president and chief executive of the American Seed Trade Association. The nature of the seed industry is to create diversity and create new varieties. If you can't continue to innovate, someone will innovate around you. It's too soon to tell what will happen given the recent chemical companies' consolidations, Dr. McDonald said. In the meantime, the seed vault, which doesn't store genetically modified seeds, will continue to accept deposits in an effort to preserve all the options it can. I can't anticipate what people will need in the future, Dr. Fowler said. My voice has been about saving the pieces. An old wives' tale that keeps coming up is the idea that keeping raw, unpeeled onions out will keep your family safe from illnesses such as the flu is making its rounds on Facebook. The post has been circulating for years, regularly surfacing during bad flu seasons or during the HINI outbreak in 2009. A copy and paste shared by Terry Bloom, who said her grandmother effectively treated her colds and fevers with onions, gained traction. The post said that during the flu pandemic in 1919, an unnamed doctor discovered a healthy family that had set out unpeeled onions that absorbed the bacteria, keeping the family healthy. The post claimed that most recently, an unnamed hairdresser used unpeeled onions successfully in her shop. The post talks about a friend using onions to treat pneumonia. I came across an article that said to cut off both ends of an onion, put it into an empty jar, and place the jar next to the sick patient at night, the post said. It said the onion would be black in the morning from the germs. Sure enough, that happened just like that. The onion was a mess, and I began to feel better. The post does not specifically talk about COVID-19. The Post claim onions can cause food poisoning as they are a magnet for bacteria. Leaving unpeeled onions out has been cited as a folk remedy since at least the 1500s, according to a Snopes fact check in 2009 on a similar post. It's so common a legend that it's even slipped into an episode of The Simpsons. Fact checks by Snopes, the Wall Street Journal, and the Associated Press found no scientific evidence that onions filter the air. There's no scientific evidence that a cut raw onion absorbs germs or rids the air of toxins or poisons, the National Onion Association says on its website. In fact, onions' own juices are antimicrobial, which means they fight bacteria rather than attract it, the trade group says. It points out that cold and flu viruses are primarily spread by contact, not by floating in the air, where the onion can supposedly attract or destroy them. Onions do have some medical and pharmacological uses recognized by the World Health Organization. Onion tea is listed in the World Health Organization literature as a way to help a runny nose. The WHO points to four scientific articles over the year in which onions were found to kill pathologens relating to food poisoning, a claim that the National Onion Association makes as well. The Center for Food Safety at the University of Georgia states that the juice released from a cut onion is known to kill or inhibit the growth of several kinds of microorganisms, including some of those capable of causing food poisoning in humans, the trade group says. The final conclusions: the onions have recognized health benefits. There's no scientific evidence that an unpeeled onion can absorb germs and protect from viruses or bacteria. It's also false that onions are a magnet for food poisoning. This proves to be an interesting story, even if it's not true. A woman named B. Wilson often has an article in the Wall Street Journal titled Table Talk, and I want to share this article with you. She begins, "One of the things that the pandemic has revealed is what we really want to eat when there's no one around to impress. The answer, as often as not, is eggs. When all the special occasions have been canceled, there's little call for special occasion dining. But you still need foods that make you feel special. Nothing does that quicker than an egg, unless you're a vegan. According to Google Trends, recipe searching on the internet has been at an all-time high during the quarantine. But the recipes Americans are searching for don't tend to be elaborate dinner party foods or clean plate salads brimming with virtue and seeds. In May, Google Trends released data on the most searched for recipes for each state in the United States. Almost all the foods were ones that spoke of basic pleasures. Cinnamon rolls were the most searched for recipe in Montana and Oregon. In Michigan and Indiana, it was hamburgers. But in Pennsylvania and Colorado, I was charmed to see that the item most recipe seekers was egg salad. Egg salad has seldom been in the spotlight before. Like deviled eggs, which are like egg salad dressed up for company, egg salad is a reminder of simpler, less showy times. I never heard anyone say that for the last meal on earth they want an egg salad sandwich. When I was little, I would pray that my mother wouldn't send me to school with egg salad sandwiches. Not because I didn't like them, but they were embarrassingly messy to eat in public. They smelled stronger than ham sandwiches, and for a clumsy child, they were impossible to eat without again mayonnaise all over myself. Yet now, when times are tough and we're left to our own devices in our kitchens, the frugal charm of egg salad had come into focus. Like all egg dishes, egg salad offers richness, softness, and protein for a very low price. And in a state of social isolation, if you drop mayo on your shirt, no one is around to witness it. The late restaurant owner, Kenny Shopson, proprietor of Shopson's in New York City, observed in his 2008 cookbook, Eat Me, that when his customers ate eggs, they would get a peaceful look on their face and go someplace else. He noticed that everyone had their own particular egg order, from scrambled eggs to sunny side up, and that eating it seemed to take them back to childhood. For some, that special order might be a poached egg on buttered toast. Others might prefer an egg salad sandwich with potato chips on the side. Egg salad is not hard to make as long as you know how to open a jar of mayonnaise and boil some eggs. Lower the eggs into simmering water, set the timer for 11 minutes, and gently transfer to a bowl filled with cold water before peeling. A good rule of thumb is to allow a tablespoon of mayo for every two eggs. The eggs can be chopped with a knife or mashed with a fork, whichever you prefer. Personally, I would add a smidgen of Dijon mustard and a scattering of chopped chives. Some insist on chopped celery, but to me, that stringy texture interrupts the softness of the eggs. I save my celery for tuna. But I wouldn't say no to a splash of pickle juice or some chopped dill. If you're feeling energetic, egg salad is even better when made with homemade mayonnaise, and you can use any leftover for a French dish, which is mayo on a half of a hard-boiled egg, which are a strong contender for the greatest cheap luxury of all time. However you prepare it, the appeal of egg salad isn't just about the taste, it's about how the memories it provokes. When people in Colorado and Pennsylvania searched for egg salad, they were looking for something to reassure them that even these hard times, not everything has changed. The food writer John Thorne described egg dishes as intimate cuisine because they're quickly made and almost infinitely adaptable as well as unexpectedly delicious. I agree. My closest moments with my teenage children have almost always have been at the kitchen table sharing a dish of Middle Eastern shakshuka. That's eggs poached in a spicy tomato sauce seasoned with cumin and paprika. When we peruse the refrigerator and discover a dozen eggs, how rich we are, wrote San Francisco chefs Gail Peary and John Clark in their delightful book, Country Egg, City Egg. Very few hot meals are as quickly made as those involving eggs, yet a well-prepared egg dinner never tastes like a compromise. You can have a delicate rolled omelet on the table in just a few minutes, but those you serve it to will feel you've given them a treat, brunch for dinner. My current favorite egg dish is savory Parmesan French toast. This isn't the regular sweet French toast that you eat with maple syrup, but a savory version that works for supper on those days when your appetite is heartier than your desire to cook. You whisk eggs with Parmesan cheese, milk, mustard, paprika. Having soaked a few slices of sourdough bread in this eggy mixture, You fry the bread gently in butter and oil, spooning the remaining mixture over. The crispy brown pieces become custardy inside like a cheese souffle. And when you take the first bite, you find your mind drifting to happier times, because like all the best egg dishes, it tastes like home. That's one dish I'd like to sample. Miss Wilson's stories are always interesting and appetizing. Don't be discouraged if you aren't clocking 10,000 steps a day. That threshold, often billed as a minimum for good health, originated in marketing, not medicine. When a Japanese company launched a pedometer in 1965, named in English the 10,000 step meter, with the slogan, "Let's walk 10,000 steps a day." That really is the origin, said I. Min Lee, a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School who researches the role of physical activity in promoting health and preventing disease. It was not a scientific study. Since then, 10,000 steps have become the goal for fitness trackers, smartphone apps, and even some corporate wellness programs whose financial rewards are based on the number of steps an employee logs each day. But walking as few as 4,400 steps a day is beneficial, according to Dr. Lee, who has analyzed the relationship between step volume and mortality. Her study, a collaboration with researchers at Harvard, the University of Tokyo, the University of Tennessee, the National Institute of Aging, and the National Cancer Institute, examined 16,741 women in age from 62 to 101. They wore hip-mounted accelerometers to track their movements for at least 10 hours a day over 4 to 7 days between 2011 and 2015. Among the group, walking approximately 4,400 steps a day was associated with a 41% reduction in mortality compared with walking 2,700 steps a day. Walking around 7,500 steps was associated with a 65% reduction. If you do get to 10,000, you're definitely going to get health benefits, said Dr. Lee. It's not wrong, but it might be a harder goal for some people. Knowing that walking less is worthwhile could encourage people to find the higher target, which is about 5 miles, unattainable. If I had to put a number on it, I'd say try to add 2,000 steps than you already do, Dr. Lee said. Americans typically walk around 4,800 steps a day. Japanese take 7,000 to 7,500. Australians and Swiss nationals take 9,000 to 10,000. And older Orange Amish cover 14,000 to 18,000. The researchers said the results of their observational study, which was published last year, might not apply to people who are more or less active than the women they analyzed. The group that was primarily white, of a higher socioeconomic status than average, and walked an average of 5,499 steps a day. But a separate study published in May, based on a representative sample of U.S. adults age 40 and older, found something similar. Walking more than 10,000 steps a day was beneficial, the study found, but so was walking less. It used individuals who walked 4,000 steps a day as a reference point and compared them with people who were more active. Taking 8,000 steps a day was associated with a 51% decreased mortality rate over the time of the study period, according to Pedro F. St. Maurice, a research scientist at the National Cancer Institute and one of the study's authors. Taking 12,000 steps a day was associated with a 65% reduction in risk. Rather than aiming for a certain number of steps, the physical activities guidelines by the Department of Health and Human Services recommends getting 150 minutes to 300 minutes of moderate exercise, such as brisk walking, each week, or 75 to 150 minutes of vigorous exercise, such as jogging. But the success of activity trackers suggests that many people prefer to count steps. In the first quarter of this year, 32.6 million wearable health and fitness devices valued at $4.6 billion was spent worldwide, according to Raymond T. Lamas, the research director for mobile services at IDU, a market research firm based in Framingham, Massachusetts. Fitbit, a San Francisco company that specializes in activity trackers, accounted for $2.2 million of the units. I think there's a beauty in the 10,000-step goal, said Shelton Yang, Fitbit's vice president of research. It's very easy to remember, and for most people, it's a target that's achievable and gets people to move more. So if so, that's a plus. I cannot emphasize more strongly how important physical activity is for health, Dr. Lee said. Even modest amounts benefit your health. It's not like you have to go out and run a marathon or walk 10,000 steps a day. So the word is, get moving. This story appeared in the News Observer on January the 1st of 2020. Can you believe it's only been 4 months since we talked about 2020 as the year of the barbecue renaissance in the Triangle? Yeah, me too. But it's true. As originally in March, we were salivating at the prospect as many as a dozen new barbecue joints in the area, including ventures by renowned pit masters Ed Mitchell and Sam Jones. You could practically smell wood smoke wafting all the way from Big Belly Q in Chapel Hill to Prime Barbecue in Knightdale, and still further if you include the reopening of the legendary Wilbur's in Goldsboro. The pandemic splashed cold water on the embers of promise, at least for some of these projects, but it didn't entirely quench the flames. Pit masters are responding to the challenge in a number of ways, some offering takeouts only, others delaying the opening of their restaurants. Wyatt Dixon is doing both. Dixon owns Picnic in Durham with Ryan Butler, whose Green Button Farm supplies the pasture-raised hogs that Dixon cooks the traditional way over hardwood coals. He's offering contact-free takeout and delivery within a five-mile radius of the restaurant. He recently opened the patio for dine-in customers from 11 a.m. to 8:30 p.m. Plans to keep the dining room closed until everybody's ready to come back out, and I feel that'll be a while. Mr. Dixon also announced plans to reopen a second joint called Wyatt's this fall in Raleigh, but pushed back the opening till sometime next year. In meantime, he's offering Raleigh a tantalizing taste of what's to come in the form of a weekly contact-free takeout from a table set up in the front of the future site of Wyatt's. Call in your order by Wednesday by 3 p.m. and pick it up by Thursday between 4 and 6 p.m. It's recommended you should buy a bottle of Mr. Dixon's Pig Whistle Sauce, a mixture of Eastern and Western-style sauces. Things may be difficult, but if you want good old North Carolina barbecue, it's available. Wegmans has become one of the country's most famous grocery chains by pampering its customers with cooking demonstrations, restaurants, and movie nights. Now every customer is a potential risk. The shift required by the age of contravirus represents an existential change to the 104-year-old family-owned company as it upends a shopping experience that made it a household name across U.S. Northeast. The chain's famous food bars, which sell everything from pizza to sushi, are closed. Its beloved free samples are gone. It removed varieties of pasta sauce, yogurt, and butter as Wegmans loaded up on basic staples. Its stores, built to represent European-style market halls, now features plexiglass dividers at cash registers and more security guards to keep customers in line. A huge part of our business has been treating our customers really as guests and entertaining them. We can't do that anymore. Danny Wegman, Wegman's Food Market Incorporated's 73-year-old chairman, said in an interview, "We lost our mojo. We have to replace it." The same dilemma is now a core problem for more businesses that constructed a culture around indulging the customer. Walt Disney Company, known for feeding customers to its theme parks with extreme attention to cleanliness and order, plans to reopen Disney World in July with mandatory temperature screenings, a social distancing squad that will encourage visitors to stay 6 feet apart, and no meet or greet with famous Disney characters. The businesses that might have an easier time for this transition are those that refrain from over-pampering when times were good. Warehouse-style retailers like Costco Wholesale Company and Home Depot long ago designed their stores to be more utilitarian than customer fantasy land. Before the pandemic started, Wegmans had one of the strongest customer followings of any supermarket in the country. Its most royal loyal shoppers who were called themselves Wegmaniacs turned up in thousands for storerooms. The chain, founded by John and Walter Wegman, regularly appeared on the list of best places to work, thanks to benefits like the like of health coverage and tuition for part and full-time workers, as well as culinary training for in-store chefs. It generates nearly $10 billion a year in annual sales and employs 52,000 workers. That famed loyalty among customers and workers was tested as the pandemic spread in March, culminating in what Wegman's managers called Black Thursday, March the 12th. Across the company's stores, shoppers were buying loads of non-perishable foods and household products, cleaning shelves while fresh food sections remained quiet. I've never seen the toilet paper shelves completely empty. Canned vegetables gone, pasta gone, said Mr. Wegman, who visited the Pittsford, New York location that day. Wegman's management realized they had to reorganize its business immediately. The company closed the large on-site restaurants, which made up 10% of its sales. In-house chefs have been redeployed to work registers, run sanitation, and manage carts in the parking lot. Seafood departments stopped displaying on ice, and deli counters stopped slicing deli meats to order. Also gone were the copious free samples and a dozen so cooking demonstrations the store held every week. Safety emerged as a prime concern for employees who feared for their health. Colleen Wegman, 49, the grocery chain's chief executive, and Mr. Wegman's daughter worried about her father. The two live next door to each other in Rochester, New York, and share a yard. Colleen grew up visiting Wegman's stores on Saturday with her grandfather, father, and sister, Nicole Wegman, another company executive. Colleen and Danny started driving to Wegman's Rochester headquarters separately. We need to keep our stores open, said Bob Farr, senior vice president of store operations, who started working for Wegman's at age 16. In order for us to be open, we had to keep our employees safe. That was job one. They lowered the number of shoppers and workers in the store to 15 to 20% capacity. It also introduced job-protected voluntary leave to part-time and full-time employees at stores and warehouses. Customers were required to wear masks, and stores closed their doors if lines at the checkouts went more than two deep. Waits at the checkouts were longer because they were required to wipe down the conveyor belt after each customer checks out. New customer behavior is materializing, too, as shoppers visit the stores less but buy more. Saturday and Sunday used to be Wegman's busiest days. Today it's more evenly divided throughout the week. Our business used to be quality and service, Mr. Wegman, the company's chairman, told more than 15 store managers who dialed in for a virtual meeting on a recent Saturday. It's changed to serve our customers and our people from a safe food standpoint. You're stepping up. We've run out of time for today's episode of Thought for Food. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Bob Kruger, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and blind audience. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138.